Welcome to the Lincoln Legacy Lecture Series, a presentation of the Center for State Policy and Leadership at the Springfield campus of the University of Illinois and WUIS Public Radio. I'm Barbara Ferrara. The UIS Lincoln Legacy Lecture Series calls on scholars and policy experts to talk about issues that engaged Abraham Lincoln and the citizens of his era and that are still timely today. The subject of this, the 12th annual lectures, is Lincoln's funeral, to provide historical background for the 150th anniversary commemoration of Abraham Lincoln's funeral in Springfield in 2015. Our lectures this year feature Dr. Richard Whiteman Fox, professor of history at the University of Southern California, and James L. Swanson, senior legal scholar at the Heritage Foundation. We'll begin with Mr. Swanson's lecture, I Give You My Sprig of Lilac, The Death and Funeral of Abraham Lincoln.
I came to Springfield this morning from up north, from my hometown, Chicago. Whenever I take the train down, I can't help but think of two other trains. One of them departed Springfield on the morning of February 11th, 1861. On board was the President-elect of the United States. And at the station, in a brief farewell address, he told his friends and neighbors that I now leave, not knowing when or whether ever I may return. The second train steamed into Springfield 150 years ago this spring, on the morning of May 3rd, 1865. Aboard a special railroad car were two coffins bearing the bodies of a father and son, Abraham and Willie Lincoln. The 1,645-mile death pageant that carried President Lincoln from Washington, D.C. back home to Springfield is among the great American journeys. Like the explorations of Lewis and Clark, the settling of the West, the building of the Transcontinental Railroad, or even the landing on the moon, the rise and fall of Abraham Lincoln, martyr to his cause, altered our history and added to our myths. The assassination, mourning, and funeral train of Lincoln and the legend of America's emancipating secular saint haunt American history down to the latest generation. Let me begin with the living Abraham Lincoln. April 14th, 1865 was one of the happiest days of his life. And if I could turn back the clock a few hours before John Wilkes Booth walked into Ford's Theater, this is what I like to imagine. It's the White House, Good Friday morning, the president at breakfast with his eldest son, Robert, who regales his parents with an eyewitness account of General Lee's surrender. Later that morning, Lincoln presides over a cabinet meeting, free for once of crises, battle news, casualty figures, and countless problems requiring the president's immediate attention. Victory had elated him, and ever since Lee's surrender on April 9th, Lincoln had been more buoyant than at any other time in his presidency. He expected more good news from General Sherman soon. I had this strange dream again last night, Lincoln said. He recalled he was in a singular, indescribable vessel, moving with great rapidity towards an indefinite shore. He had, he said, experienced this dream before Fort Sumter, Bull Run, Antietam, Gettysburg, and other great conflicts. Lincoln had always believed in and sometimes feared the power of dreams. And this dream, he was certain, foretold the coming of a great event. But before it occurred, he wanted to take a carriage ride with his wife, Mary. The war had increased their estrangement. Official Washington, under a heavy Southern influence, had snubbed her as a gatecrasher and a Western parvenu from the start, despite her aristocratic Kentucky origins. She had been emotionally distraught since the death of their favorite son, 11-year-old Willie, in February 1862. She had even fallen under the spells of mediums and spiritualists at White House seances. Lincoln scorned her infatuation with the spirit world, though he once attended one of her supernatural events. Of course, word got out. The president was humiliated, and that caused a sheet music parody to be published called The Dark Seance Polka. The cover art depicted a wild executive mansion seance with objects and violins flying through the air. Lincoln knew that had to change now. He wanted to talk about the future. He escorted Mary to the open carriage, and before the coachman drove off, she asked Abraham if anyone should accompany them on a ride. "No," he replied, "I prefer to ride by ourselves today." Lincoln's joy was irrepressible. Mary had noticed on their recent river cruise. Down the Potomac, he was almost boyish in his mirth and reminded me of his original nature, which I've always remembered of him, in our home, free from care, surrounded by those he loved so well. Now, during their afternoon ride, Mary spoke to him about his happy mood. "Dear husband, you almost startle me by your great cheerfulness." "And well may I feel so, Mary. I consider this day the war has come to a close. We must both be more cheerful in the future. Between the war and the loss of our darling Willie, we have both been very miserable." The president told her that they must try to be happy again, that he would like to see the Pacific Ocean, that perhaps at the end of his second term in March 1869, they would move to Chicago and he would practice law again. Freed from the vexations of war and death, he would have to send no more armies of young men to die. Lincoln dreamed of the future. Yes, they would be happy again. The lookout at Ford's spotted the big black carriage turning down 10th Street. The Lincolns, Major Rathbone and Clara Harris, disembarked, and the chief usher escorted them through the lobby, up the winding staircase, across the dress circle to their box. Abraham Lincoln's entry to Ford's Theater at 8:30 p.m. on April 14, 1865, was majestic in its simplicity. He arrived with no entourage, no armed guards, and no announcement to the crowd. Before the presidential party reached the box, the actors, musicians, and patrons became aware that the Lincolns had arrived. The audience shouted and cheered, the players stopped performing, and the conductor led his orchestra in a stirring rendition of Hail to the Chief. At the supreme moment of victory, the audience went wild and cheered their father Abraham, the man who, after a shaky start in office, learned how to command armies, grew in vision and eloquence, brought down slavery, and who just 6 weeks ago had given the most graceful and emotionally stunning inaugural address in the history of the presidency. And, as he promised he would, he had saved the Union. Lincoln stood in the box and bowed to the audience. The spontaneous homage, the festive band, the hissing gas lights, the packed house, the fresh, moist scent of spring in the air, the recent joyous news from the front, all combined to create a singular and magical moment. The Lincolns took their seats. The play resumed. At one point, the president stood up and put on his coat. The cool night air had chilled him. Back in his rocking chair, Lincoln reached out and held Mary's hand. In mock embarrassment, she chided him for his boldness. "What will Miss Harris think of my hanging on to you so?" Lincoln laughed and said, "She won't think anything about it." Those were the last words. You know what comes next. You know it so well that it hardly needs retelling. A man is seen entering the president's box. A single shot, the flashing knife, the leap to the stage, a triumphant cry, the escape into the wings, a galloping horse, and a dying president lying on the floor in a theater gone mad. He was carried across the street to the Peterson House. And what happened next, over the next 8.5 hours, was no less than the transfiguration of Abraham Lincoln from mortal man to martyred saint. The death vigil began by midnight as news spread throughout the Capitol. High and low, generals, cabinet secretaries, members of Congress, close friends, freed blacks, curiosity seekers, they all came, a steady procession of mourners. Lincoln lingered to sunrise. He drew his last breath at 7:21 and 55 seconds. At 7:22 and 10 seconds, his heart stopped beating. He was dead. No one knew it yet. But the mourning that began in the back room of the boarding house in downtown Washington would continue well beyond Lincoln's death. What began there could not be contained. Soon, the assassination would set in motion strange forces, a national phenomenon, the likes of which America had never seen. In the days to come, the footsteps of millions of Americans would join the small procession that began, in the words of Walt Whitman, that moody, tearful night. The first funeral procession in Washington began later that morning when soldiers escorted him home to the White House. Of course, a funeral would have to be planned. Of course, it would be in Washington. But then what? What would become of Abraham Lincoln's body? The funeral ceremonies in Washington would be the largest and most elaborate series of public events ever held in the nation's capital and possibly in the entire nation. Only the Army could organize such a logistical event of that complexity. A public viewing for the White House on April 19th, a private funeral at the White House attended by hundreds of dignitaries on April 19th, followed immediately by a grand, synchronized, incomparable procession from the White House to the Capitol, a lying in state and public viewing of the corpse in the rotunda of the Great Dome on April 20th, the departure of the president's remains from Washington on April 21st. One man was found, Assistant Secretary of the Treasury George Harrington was found, a forgotten man in history who single-handedly organized the entire Abraham Lincoln funeral in Washington and then had it carried out by the U.S. Army. But then what, after those plans were made? On April 17th, Secretary of War Stanton sought a private meeting with Mary Lincoln and her son Robert. He needed to find out their next desires. Where would Abraham Lincoln be buried? Official Washington wanted to inter him in the U.S. Capitol. Requests came in from Chicago, from Kentucky, other places. Springfield even made a try. In fact, it infuriated Mary Lincoln. She was appalled that Springfield leading citizens had already begun an extravagant scheme to buy an entire city block and erect a stupendous monument to her husband. And Mary viewed that as a hometown conspiracy to hijack her husband's remains. And she vowed to thwart this grandiose plan. And emotional telegrams went back and forth between the Illinois delegation in Washington, between people back home. Orville Hickman Browning got involved. Mary Lincoln refused to receive him at the White House. Perhaps, she hinted, it might be Washington or Chicago or somewhere else. When people in Springfield learned later that Mary Lincoln would not be on the train, she would not accompany the body here to Springfield, all of Springfield rejoiced that they would not have to see her again. That's an entirely additional story that my friend Michael Burlingame is the expert on Mary Lincoln. I share his views, but that's another subject, so we won't turn more to Mary tonight. Once she decided it would be Springfield, the Secretary of War had to deal with a huge logistical issue, taking the president on the 1,600-mile journey. It was modeled after the inaugural journey of 1861, when Lincoln went on a circuitous trip through the North to meet his supporters on the way to Washington. Now, he would approximate a similar journey. Not all the same cities, not exactly the same route, but the idea was that he would link again with the American people as he'd done in 1861. A groundswell of public opinion demanded that he be sent through the country on a circuitous route, not directly back to Springfield. The American people couldn't come to Washington to see this funeral, but they could come to their own hometowns or major cities of the North and watch as Lincoln's coffin was taken through their cities. And speaking of that coffin, it was an interesting thing. His first coffin in Washington was a plain wooden ammunition crate brought by soldiers to the Peterson House. Lincoln's naked body was wrapped in sheets and an American flag, and he was laid in that coffin. Soldiers screwed the lid tight. Lincoln wouldn't have been displeased with that. It was the rough-hewn coffin of a rail splitter, not unlike the coffin he had helped fashion for his own mother as a boy, not unlike the coffin that took Ann Rutledge and her hopes and her body to the grave. And now he was in a similar coffin. Of course, official Washington put him in a grandiose $1,500 expensive coffin as soon as they could. They spent over $30,000 on the Lincoln funeral. The procession in Washington was magnificent. Six white horses carried the hearse. 50,000 people in the march, 50,000 spectators, everyone wearing mourning badges and ribbons on their arms. Every bell in the city rang. It took hours for the procession to go 1.5 miles from the White House to the Capitol after the funeral in the White House. And then they took him to the East Front and carried him up the stairs past the very spot where 6 weeks ago he had stood in that brilliant sunbeam and declared, with malice toward none, with charity for all. Close to midnight that night, Secretary of War Stanton sent out a telegraph announcing the final route. Not every city could be accommodated. Stanton wrote, "It has finally been concluded to conform to the announcement made earlier today. The cities are Baltimore, Harrisburg, Philadelphia, New York City, Albany, Buffalo, Cleveland, Columbus, Chicago, and then Springfield." After the viewing of 100,000 people on the morning of April 21st, the body was taken to the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad Station. Someone was waiting for him on that train, aside from the 150 soldiers and officers and generals, aside from the bomber and the assistant bomber. His son Willie was waiting for him on the train in his little coffin. Men had been sent to Oak Hill Cemetery in Georgetown, where Lincoln had temporarily placed Willie in a small tomb, no bigger than the size of a child's playhouse. It was Lincoln's plan to reclaim the boy in 1869 and bring him home on the great journey west. Now Willie waited for him in his coffin in that railroad car until his father joined him there. The story of Willie is certainly one of the saddest journeys of the assassination. The train reached Baltimore, the first stop, an odd place given what a secessionist town it was, given that Lincoln was almost murdered there in a conspiracy plot in 1861, but he couldn't really go north without going through Baltimore. The train was scheduled to stop many times for official honors, processions, ceremonies, viewings, but for the most part, those plans were just dry words on paper, miles and railroad timetables. These documents said nothing about what was to come. What was going to happen is something that no one planned and no one knew would happen. The spontaneous bonfires, the torches, the floral arches, the hand-painted signs, the banners, the masses of people assembled all along the way, all hours of the day and night, in sun, in rain, in storm. The Secretary of War did not expect the funeral train to take on a life of its own and to become a venerated symbol in its own right. The train's progress fed not just on firewood and water, but on human passions to animate its momentum. At each stop, it took aboard the tone and temper of each town and its people. The moving train was like a tuning fork or an amplifier. The more time it spent on the road and the greater distance it traveled, the more it picked up the sympathetic vibrations of the nation's pride and grief. It intensified and harmonized the emotions of the people. It became more than the funeral train for one dead man. It evolved into something else. What happened was not decreed, nor could it be resisted. Somewhere between Washington and Springfield, the train became a universal symbol of the cost of the Civil War. It came to represent a mournful homecoming for all the lost men, and the heartbroken and collective judgment of the American people, an army of the dead, not just the commander-in-chief, rode aboard that train. In Baltimore, the tone was set. Massive quantities of flowers, lilacs especially. It was also decided that no one may touch the coffin. Only the honor guard riding with the president could remove his coffin from the train, set it up for public display. And another rule, no kissing of the corpse. Women had to be held back from hurling their bodies upon Lincoln's. But because it was decided in Washington, just as at the White House and at the Capitol, this was going to be an open coffin all the way back to Springfield. In spring, in warm weather, without proper preservatives, the embalmers were the two most important men on that train, aside from General Townsend, the commander of the train. April 21st, the train arrives in Harrisburg. Ceremonies are held. The coffin is taken to a place of honor. Tens of thousands of people gather. It leaves Harrisburg on April 22nd. It arrives in Philadelphia on the afternoon of Saturday, April 22nd. There's a vast crowd, a huge procession. It takes 3 hours for the procession to get from the train station to Independence Hall. Lincoln's body is carried into that sacred hall of the American Revolution. The lid is removed, his body is displayed, and the crowd is stunned to see what is done to honor Abraham Lincoln. They've laid the head of his coffin at the foot of the Liberty Bell. In 1861, Lincoln stopped in Philadelphia. He raised the flag, and he said, rather than give up the principles represented by the American Revolution, he said these words, "I would rather be assassinated on this spot." And 4 years later, there he lies assassinated at the foot of the Liberty Bell. The crowds went wild. Newspaper accounts say women had almost every article of clothing torn from their bodies in the scrum as people pushed forward. Left Philadelphia after April 24th, just after midnight. The funeral train arrived in New York City on April 24th. New York put on a wild presentation in a way that only New York, 19th century New York, could do. They outdid every city in the funeral journey so far. Massive crowds, massive floral displays, and of course, where but New York City would someone dare attempt to photograph the corpse of Abraham Lincoln? Which is exactly what was done. The famous gurney photograph of Lincoln in the coffin. Secretary of War Stanton ordered Townsend to fire the man who allowed this. General Townsend said, "It's me. I'll relieve myself of command." The photo was taken in good taste. Stanton left him in command. They leave New York on April 25th. And then a miraculous sight happened going north, all the way up the Hudson. Torches, bonfires, crowds, signs. Townsend wrote, as the funeral train moved west, quote, "As the president's remains went farther westward, where the people were more especially claiming him as their own, the intensity of feeling seemed, if possible, to grow deeper. The night journey of the 27th and 28th was all through torches, bonfires, mourning drapery, mottos, and solemn music." After ceremonies in Albany and Buffalo, the train pushed across the Ohio state line. General Townsend noted, it got even more intense. In Cleveland, there wasn't a building big enough to hold the crowd. They built a giant drapery Chinese pagoda-style building. 100,000 people came in a pouring rain to see Lincoln's body. On to Columbus on Saturday, April 29th, as in Cleveland, the same wild, intense reception. There, some children remembered Willie, whose coffin was never removed from the train during the journey. That morning, they picked wild violets from fields, and the mother of one of them brought the violets to the funeral car and was allowed to place them on Willie's coffin with a letter from the children that said, "We feel so sorry for him." Someone wrote a song about Willie and Abraham. Lyrics include, "Willie, on the earth look back. Father, 'tis a speck of black, robed in mourning as you see, mourns the earth for you and me." But the song was wrong, of course. If Willie had actually looked down from heaven, he would have seen through the night sky not only a speck of black, the orb of the earth, he would have seen a ribbon of flame unspooling across the land as torches and bonfires marked their way home. On Sunday, April 30th, the train reached Indianapolis, similar reception, then pushed on to Chicago. On the morning of May 1st, the train arrives in Chicago, where 10,000 children are waiting for it. The biggest arch constructed on the journey so far is over the railroad tracks. 36 women in white, representing the states of the Union, pay homage to Lincoln. Chicagoans wait in a line 1 mile long on May 2nd to view his corpse. Chicago, of course, made a special claim that they were the ones who discovered Lincoln. They tried to steal Springfield's glory. And the Chicago Tribune said that Chicago is the first city that summoned Lincoln from obscurity. And certainly, as he died, his face was turning west to face Chicago. On the night of May 2nd, the train leaves Chicago. The excitement on the train is now increased. This was the last night. It's a fever pitch in Springfield. The signs along the way, Lockport, a banner says, "Come home." In Bloomington, "Go to thy rest." in Lincoln with malice toward none. Springfield was restless on the night of May 2nd and on the morning of May 3rd. The people had waited 20 days since Lincoln's death and 13 days since the train had left Washington. Because of Mary, they weren't even sure that Springfield was going to get the body. Over the next 2 days, Springfield would show the nation that no town loved Lincoln more. The funeral train steamed into town at 8:40 in the morning on May 3rd. He'd been on the move since April 21st. It was as though, as long as the train was moving, he wasn't quite dead. General Townsend had done it. The journey went on without a mishap. It was peaceful, no riots. Across the country, 200 people had been murdered the night Lincoln was shot. The funeral train did not inspire further violence. So Lincoln was home. He was taken to the State House, where for the first time on the funeral train journey, there was a 24-hour viewing of the corpse. 75,000 people viewed it. Then he's taken to Oak Ridge Cemetery. There, Bishop Matthew Simpson says, "Far more eyes have gazed upon the face than have ever looked upon the face of any departed man." Carl Sandburg described what that day was like, and even though Sandburg didn't see it, he could have been. I'm one of the historians who still likes Carl Sandburg. Yes, there were some certain factual errors. But Michael, no one aside from you has really evoked the spirit of Lincoln's time and words the way Sandburg has. So let me mention how Sandburg described it. "Evergreen carpeted the stone floor of the vault. On the coffin set in a receptacle of black walnut, they arranged flowers carefully and precisely. They poured flowers as symbols. They lavished heaps of fresh flowers as though there could never be enough to tell either their hearts or his. And the night came with great quiet, and there was rest. The prairie years, the war years were over." Newspapers across the country reported every detail of every procession, the dignitaries, the kinds of flowers, the quantity, the signs, the banners, the people who made the funeral hearses. No detail was too little to be reported. They reported the details of the tents, the draperies, like they were interior decorators, not war reporters. This allowed the American people to imagine what it was like. 1 million had viewed the corpse. 7 million had watched the train go by. Tens of millions read these accounts. The funeral train really became a kind of ark of the American covenant, possessing hidden meanings and mysterious powers. The death pageant was both a civic and military event, and a religious event. Through the national funeral events, Americans mourned the death of their president and elevated him to the pantheon of American political sainthood, equaled only by George Washington. And of course, the symbolism allowed a great catharsis. This outpouring was not for just one man, not for you, for one alone. "Blossoms and branches green to coffins all I bring," wrote Walt Whitman. And so they mourned, not for this one man alone, but for all the men, every son, every brother, every lover, every husband, every father lost in that war. It was as though on that train, in that coffin, they were all coming home with Abraham Lincoln. Lincoln's death pageant was a glorious farewell for him and to the 360,000 men of the Union who, like their father Abraham, had perished for cause and country. Little evidence today remains in the funeral train. The railroad steam engine is long gone. All the cars are gone. The presidential car is gone. The railroad beds still exist. Those rarely change. People today riding north home from Manhattan after each work day don't realize they're riding home along the Lincoln funeral route. Today, when I rode the train down from Chicago, I looked at each town through which I passed, and I remembered the exact wording of the signs that was held up in banners in those towns. The Lincoln funeral has such powerful imagery that in November 1963, another widow remembered it. And when she landed at Andrews Air Force Base in Washington, And she was asked by the chief of protocol, "How may I serve you?" Jacqueline Kennedy said, "Make it like Lincoln's." And so I just close with these final thoughts, which I think are the best and most eloquent words ever written about the death and funeral of Abraham Lincoln. And of course, they have to be by Walt Whitman. "O powerful western fallen star, O shades of night, O moody, tearful night, coffin that passes through lanes and streets with the tolling bell's perpetual clang, here, coffin that slowly passes, I give you my sprig of lilac." Thank you.
That was James L. Swanson, senior legal scholar at the Heritage Foundation and the author of Manhunt, The 12-Day Chase for Lincoln's Killer, and its sequel, Bloody Crimes, The Funeral of Abraham Lincoln and the Chase for Jefferson Davis. You're listening to Lincoln's Funeral, a presentation of the 12th Annual UIS Lincoln Legacy Lectures. Next, Dr. Richard Whiteman Fox, professor of history at the University of Southern California, discusses what we've forgotten about Lincoln's funeral and what we've never known.
It's a thrill for me to be in Springfield during the preparations for the 150th anniversary of his funeral. When I was a kid growing up in Los Angeles, I got hooked on a TV travel show called Bill Burrard's Adventure. And I remember the episode in 1960 called Lincoln Country. I appreciated all the individual Lincoln shrines and sites in Kentucky, Indiana, and Illinois, but I was especially struck by Illinois, partly because of its name. Such a weirdly wonderful name for a state. How could you possibly pronounce O-I-S, oi? In that impossibly faraway place called Illinois, some lucky people actually got to live among the tangible traces of Lincoln's adulthood. Half a century later, while researching my book, I read a Chicago Tribune feature story from the 1980s on tourism in Springfield, and the reporter started the story with Lincoln's tomb. He was standing outside the tomb near the bust of Lincoln by Gutzon Borglum and was startled by a woman touching Lincoln's nose and whispering as she rubbed it. Leaning toward Lincoln's ear, she said tenderly, "There you go, dear boy." The journalist seemed to think that he, an emissary from cosmopolitan Chicago, had stumbled upon some exotic ritual of a primitive tribe. "The sense you get here in Springfield," he wrote, "and it's rather spooky, is that Lincoln died recently." I think that in spite of being spooked, the journalist had noticed something important. He might have put it differently, though. Instead of saying that in Springfield that Lincoln had died recently, he might have said that in Springfield especially, but elsewhere too, many people still hadn't gotten over his death. Some people, even in California, can still feel he was ripped away from us, not just from our long-ago predecessors. It's no surprise we can still feel the loss of him as a sudden loss. Those Americans of four or five generations ago who experienced the loss of him firsthand wanted us to inherit that feeling from them. As they grieved for Lincoln in 1865, they imagined that future for us. That was part of their grieving. Their desire to pass along their grief was built right into their mourning. This point is the first of many things that I think we've largely forgotten about Lincoln's funeral, or else perhaps not even known. As they mourned, people were plotting out a future without Lincoln that included Lincoln and including their feeling of grief when he died. Let me advance this to the starting point. That's the theme that I'm going to develop over the next 30 minutes. Walt Whitman, to quote the very same poem that James just quoted, but thankfully a slightly different verse. Walt Whitman exhibited just this feature of the 1865 morning in his When Lilacs Last in the Dooryard Bloomed. When lilacs last in the dooryard bloomed, and the great star early drooped in the western sky in the night, I mourned, and yet shall mourn with ever-returning spring. Ever-returning spring, Trinity sure to me you bring, lilac blooming perennial, and drooping star in the west, and thought of him I love. Keep the memory of Lincoln alive, Whitman is saying, but also keep the mourning of Lincoln alive. That is mourning. And while you're at it, keep your love of him vital, not passive appreciation, but active devotion. Whitman was urging us to resist what Lincoln himself, speaking as a 28-year-old in Springfield in 1838, called the silent artillery of time, the apparently inevitable loss of fervor for our revolutionary ancestors, those who had offered their lives and given their lives for the Republic. Whitman's lines also give us a key to how people grieved in 1865. And this leads us to some other things that I believe many of us have forgotten about the funeral, or that we have indeed never known about the funeral. Most of us know that when Lincoln died, Americans mobilized by the millions to express their love and sorrow, and those who didn't now know it from James's book, and to pay their respects to his body. Some may know that they plastered their towns and cities with banners and placards giving phrases from his famous speeches. John Wilkes Booth's Derringer shot had taken away Lincoln's consciousness, so he had left no last words behind. Excerpts from his speeches provided virtual last words. Above all, the line, "with malice toward none, with charity for all." What's rarely remembered today is that Americans in 1865 honored Lincoln's dead body by remembering his living body, not just his words. They filled shop windows with photos of his face and wrote thousands of poems evoking his bodily sacrifice, reminding each other of what a homely man he was and how his body had withered during the war because of his tireless service to the people. Whitman loved Lincoln as much as anyone, and like many others in the 1860s, he loved Lincoln more because the president was so homely. I was shocked to discover when I began my research that Lincoln's friends as well as foes constantly spoke of how ugly he was. And they kept right on saying that after his death. You would have thought they would have stopped in respect of the dead, but no. They went ahead and said it in their eulogies. It struck them as an essential fact about him, one that went to the heart of his lovable character and of his career as a champion of self-making. As they kept repeating, Lincoln had himself made fun of his looks, making him, in their eyes, all the more irresistible. And he had risen to the top of American politics without any inherited advantages. No family inheritance, no solid education, no appealing physique or appealing facial features. He'd risen to prominence with unparalleled wit, uncommon intelligence, commanding presence, and an unheard of humility about his own person, including his looks. I'm going to just demonstrate this in passing with a few slides and commentary by one of those who loved Lincoln, was critical of Lincoln. He was a journalist named Don Piatt, P-I-A-T-T, and he wrote this comment in 1887, but one can find the very same comments being made in 1865. Mr. Lincoln was the homeliest man I ever saw. When in repose, his face was dull, heavy, and repellent. This is a relatively unknown photo from 1860 by Alexander Hessler, and it shows very quickly a lot of the features that people thought made Lincoln ugly in his day. It's remarkable. I mean, we don't find him ugly, I don't think, but at that time they did. The large nose, the huge ears, the great mouth, as they would say, and the scrawny neck. These things all put people off, and it made it all the more remarkable to them that he had become such a success. His face, though, and this was a common transition people commenting on Lincoln's appearance would make, his face brightened like a lit lantern when animated. His dull eyes would fairly sparkle with fun or express as kindly a look as I ever saw when moved by some matter of human interest. Now I want to just zoom in on that very photo from 1860, which was taken as such a demonstration of his ugliness. But if you focus on his eyes, you can see, I think, what Don Piette is getting at. Piette didn't notice it when Lincoln's face was still. Everyone noticed it, including Piette, when Lincoln laughed, which was all the time, which we can't get access to because cameras couldn't capture it. But I think even here in this still, we can see the intensity at the very least of his eyes. And if you saw Daniel Day-Lewis's imitation of Lincoln, I think you can catch his effort to make the eyes, the intense feature that is already present in these old photos. Northerners mourned over Lincoln's dead body then by remembering how he looked in life. And they mourned over his dead body by remembering what he had chosen to do with his living body. He had decided that as a Republican president, and the word Republican here comes with a small r, meaning anti-monarchist, not member of the Republican Party. He had decided that as a Republican president, as he told Congress in his message of July 4th, 1861, he was not going to, quote, count the chances of his own life, unquote. He would greet the people directly, physically, not from a distance, like a monarch. The clearest demonstration of this that was well known at the end of his life was his trip to Richmond, Virginia on April 4th, 1865, 10 days before the assassination. The entire Richmond trip, I can tell from teaching students at USC, is almost entirely forgotten today. It's only a rare student who has ever heard of it. But mourners dwelt on it during the funeral. In Richmond, as they had learned only a few days before Lincoln's death, he had walked 3/4 of a mile in the midst of thousands of exuberant slaves celebrating their first day of de facto freedom. He welcomed them as new members of the body politic, even as he signaled to white Southerners that a new day of reconciliation had dawned, because here he was walking hand in hand with his son, Tad, who turned 12 that very day, through the streets of Richmond. Until the assassination, newspaper reports saw this march as a Republican, small r, event, the chief magistrate greeting his fellow citizens and revitalizing the national body politic. Here you can see him intermingling with the former slaves. They're not legally free yet, but they're definitely free in fact. You can see children, Tad at the very bottom, holding his father's hand, children of slaves being held up. You can see some of the sailors who are carrying carbines to protect Lincoln. But everybody back home, Edwin Stanton and others, were apoplectic, to use James's word, about Lincoln subjecting himself to this risk. And Lincoln just blew it off. He didn't think he was taking any undue chances, but he had accepted the fact that his style of Republican leadership might well lead to harm. It was just a risk of not being a monarch. You were not going to surround yourself, in his view, by a cordon of security if you were going to be a Republican president. So before the assassination, the reports in the press emphasized the Republican meaning of this, the chief magistrate mixing with the people, serving the nation through his actions. After the assassination, a religious interpretation of the event collided directly with the Republican meaning of this. Lincoln now appeared to have entered Richmond just the way that Jesus had entered Jerusalem shortly before his death on Good Friday. Incredibly, Lincoln was shot on Good Friday. That's how it felt to people in 1865. Lincoln was no longer just a Republican devoting his body and mind to the service of the nation. He was also a divinely appointed man of saintly character, heralding a new reign of peace and goodwill. Something else that we've forgotten about the funeral, in addition to the way his body was depicted, ugly, withered, the way his body was put to the service deliberately by him, the service of the people. Something else we've forgotten about the funeral itself is that blacks and whites mourned together in dramatically new ways. This was especially noticeable in the Midwest. There had been public events before where blacks and whites had intermingled in Baltimore, Philadelphia. In the Midwest, one finds reports from black citizens or citizens-to-be that they were treated not only kindly, but with enthusiastic welcomes in places like Columbus and other Midwestern cities where this had not been the common practice before. But even as they mourned together in 1865, the content of their mourning diverged. Blacks saw no silver lining in the assassination the way many whites did, who kept saying after the assassination that in a republic, any chief magistrate can be replaced. Plus, it was good for Lincoln that he died when he did, at the peak of his powers, having demonstrated his virtue. This was a great Republican death. Black people were not persuaded that they could do without Lincoln. And I'm just going to pass quickly by a few images that are very commonly known today and often disparaged by blacks and whites alike for showing black slave in a subservient position to white master. But at the time, black people didn't feel that way at all. They felt that these images displayed the heroism of both parties, the black slave and the white emancipator. This particular black slave from the Thomas Ball statue in Washington, D.C., and a replica of it here is on display to this day in Boston at Park Place. This slave is a muscular man about to leap to freedom. And so it's just the way history happens. Enough generations go by, and people feel differently about the very images that caused an entirely different reaction in their own day. I'm going to just say one more word about African Americans, which is that they turned out for the funeral events in large numbers almost everywhere. They brought their children to the lyings in state, to the public display of Lincoln's body. The men marched in the processions wherever they were allowed to, and that was almost everywhere. The women were standing on the sidewalks as many of their men marched. On the sidewalks, white journalists often interviewed black women to find out what they thought about this event. Black women and children waited in line for hours at the lyings in state, like everyone else, eager to pass by Lincoln's coffin. African Americans startled many white mourners by their vocal response to the sight of Lincoln's body. Whites who wrote about that often praised blacks for being more expressive in their grief than whites were. Whites also brought their children to the lyings in state. Children sometimes snuck into the viewings on their own, pretending that they were related to the adult standing next to them. Chicago organizers, as James mentioned, mobilized them as a group for the procession in Chicago. Officials warned their parents that their children would have to remain standing for 3 hours without a break. Many thousands turned out. A final point to make while we're on the subject of the funeral itself, the condition of Lincoln's body as it was exposed to view. We have that lithograph from Currier and Ives, and we have finally this photograph that James mentioned, the gurney photo. This one that Secretary of War Edwin Stanton confiscated after he learned that Townsend had allowed it to be taken by Gurney. We had no idea it existed until it was discovered here in Springfield in the early 1950s. This copy I took myself, I photographed this from Life magazine, and I invite you, if you have access to the real Life magazine, and you can have access, you just go to oldlifemagazine.com and you can buy it for $20. Not if you all ask for it on the same day, probably, but it's definitely available as of yesterday on oldlifemagazine.com. This is a huge enlargement. I forget how many inches, but it's colossal. If you remember the old Life magazine, you remember how tall it was. Well, this takes up most of a page or two pages. They touched up Lincoln's face for easy recognition. The original photo does not show this clear face of Lincoln. As the funeral train progressed towards Springfield, more and more people voiced concern about the state of the corpse, and that concern was first expressed right then when the body was in New York. The very next day, the newspapers in New York began asking whether this public display of the body could actually continue, and you can imagine what fright that stirred in Chicago and in Springfield. Some began to ask, in fact, whether the honoring of Lincoln had turned into dishonoring of him by displaying a deteriorating corpse. Democratic newspapers outside of Illinois published horror stories about how hideous the body looked. In Ohio, one well-known Democratic newspaper in effect accused Stanton of desecrating the remains by sending Lincoln's body on such a punishing trip. But when Lincoln's corpse arrived in Illinois, Democratic and Republican papers in the state stopped mentioning his bodily deterioration. They united in heralding their son, their neighbor, their intimate friend. The condition of his body didn't matter. This was their boy, their man, coming home. There's a straight line between the Springfield funeral events of 1865 and the Borglum replica at the tomb installed in 1931. And venerated by American soldiers as they prepared to depart for Europe and the Pacific in World War II. It may have been they who started rubbing his nose for good luck. The genius of the Borglum replica at the tomb is its approachability. Other Lincoln statues were designed to be seen, not touched, and not whispered to. "We'll see you, old boy," the woman in Springfield said to her hero in 1987, feeling some of the same intimate attachment felt by some Springfield residents today, a quarter century later. Lincoln lived on in people's hearts because he remained so unpretentious, so self-deprecating to the end of his life. So here is the fundamental fact of Lincoln's body, as most African Americans and Northern whites believed in 1865, the biggest fact of all about the funeral, yet one that many have yet to learn, or many have yet to remember, I guess. A New York Tribune editorial in 1866 gave beautiful expression to the sentiment that Lincoln's living body, and especially his very homely face, withered by the war years, would endure and inspire those who came after him. I'll conclude with an excerpt from that editorial. Note the word temper in this excerpt, which means not anger, it means temperament. And note too that this editorial in 1866, like so many of the commentaries on Lincoln's body, and especially on his ugliness, regarded his soul as having transfigured the ugliness of his body. And the use of the word transfigured, which James also used, is important here because it shows that religious language is insinuating itself into the secular language of republicanism. And there's a bit of a merging of language systems here, secular and religious, to describe this assassinated hero. So here is the New York Tribune in 1866. Mr. Lincoln's face was so mobile, so sure a reflex of his mood, and his temper had so wide a range that it is not to be wondered at that the portraits of him differ so. People will choose from the multitude of photographs the one that best answers the notion they have formed of the man. For ourselves, we cannot separate Mr. Lincoln in our minds from the time in which he lived, nor think of him except as a man who, having mental and spiritual organization of extreme delicacy and sensitiveness, was called to bear a load of care, responsibility, and anxiety that must have left a deep and indelible mark upon his face. Time left all its bitter dealings with him written on that scarred and weather-beaten visage. And this record, the true portrait of Mr. Lincoln, must have, or miss the final verdict of acceptance. People do not want a nice portrait, nor a handsome portrait, nor an ideal portrait. They want to say, this is the man who suffered and died in our cause. Let flatterers stand aside and squeamish people. Show us the grim features, the shaggy head, the beetling brow, the big nose, the great mouth. What do we care for his homeliness? His soul transfigures this scarred and craggy face as sunset strikes against a mountainside and changes rugged cliff and black ravine and darkest wood into golden or rosy cloud. Thank you.
That was Dr. Richard Whiteman Fox, professor of history at the University of Southern California and author of Lincoln's Body, A Cultural History. You've been listening to Lincoln's Funeral, the subject of the 12th Annual Lincoln Legacy Lectures, a presentation of the Center for State Policy and Leadership at the Springfield campus of the University of Illinois and WUIS Public Radio. Theme music composed by Dennis Fisher, based on the 1865 James G. Clark song, Martyr of Liberty. Thanks for listening. I'm Barbara Ferrara.
In an ever-accelerating world with ever-faster communication, NPR's Morning Edition slows the news down.
We're going to be doing this all day. Let's work through what happened in what order as best you know right now.
Take a second look, ask one more question, and own your morning. Tomorrow with Morning Edition from NPR News.